This is our eighth session of the conference. Our speaker is Andrew Williams from Warwick on constructivism and publicity, and the commenter is Wayne Sumner from the University of Toronto. So over to you, Andrew.
What I'm going to do is express some of my current disagreements and puzzlements about Gerry's response to an article which I wrote about 10 years ago. That article is a reply to Gerry's critique of Rawls's view of incentive-generating inequalities. As you will recall, Gerry says that Rawls fails to recognize that the productive decisions workers who fully accept the difference principle would satisfy an egalitarian ethos, thereby making most inequality-generating incentives unnecessary as means to benefit the least advantaged. As a result, Rawls greatly exaggerates the extent to which the difference principle prohibits economic inequalities. Now, some reject the first claim there on the handout and say that the difference principle applies only to the basic structure and that Cohen's egalitarian ethos isn't a part of the basic structure. Gerry calls this the basic structure objection, and in an article in 1997 set out to refute it, claimed that there was a fatal ambiguity in Rawls's specification of the basic structure that wrecks the basic structure objection and produces a dilemma for Rawls's view of the subject of justice. So, let me say at this point, I feel, when I talk about this subject, really, I feel like the person who says, well, in order to understand this, you have to go all the way back to the Civil War. But then I think, actually, I shouldn't say that, because it makes the conflict sound a lot more bitter than it really is. I think of our disagreement as a kind of family dispute. It's like a family dispute and a Civil War, because people disagree about what the facts were in the past. They disagree about what different people's positions were. So a lot of what I'm going to say will just involve, I think, restating my own position and then suggesting another way in which we can understand Rawls's view in a way that I hope is attractive and which escapes some of Gerry's criticisms. So my kind of general strategy here is maybe predictable. Somebody is very influenced and very much admires two people. When there's a disagreement between them, they try to reconcile them. They try to suggest maybe the disagreement isn't as real and large as it first appears. That's going to be my strategy. So let me say first, how I understood Gerry's response to the basic structure objection, how the dilemma proceeds. Gerry says that if the basic structure is defined in exclusively legal or coercive terms, and so encompasses, say, the Constitution, legislation, public policy, then restricting Rawls's principles to the basic structure is arbitrary, there's no rationale for it, and implausible. That's one of the powerful examples he uses to demonstrate that, is to say that we can imagine a sexist ethos which encourages men to do a smaller share of domestic labour, despite even in households where both parties go out to work. Now, I agree that even a Rawlsian should be worried about that type of ethos. I think it'll have malign implications for fair equality of opportunity between men and women. And Gerry says, and this is something he particularly emphasizes in his recent book, that it's inconsistent with treating the basic structure as the primary subject of principles of justice to restrict the basic structure to legal institutions, because its profound effects, because there are lots of other profoundly influential patterns of activity. Just have a... Now, the second horn of the dilemma arises if we focus on that property of the basic structure, and we say that the basic structure is simply the major coercive and non-coercive institutions, and that, because then we'll have to allow that the basic structure can include something like Jerry's egalitarian ethos or its absence, because the presence or absence of that ethos is going to be profoundly influential. So we have a dilemma then. Either we can understand the basic structure in a very restrictive, implausible way, or instead we can allow the basic structure to be understood more expansively, and then the restriction really doesn't rule out the claim that the difference principle requires the egalitarian ethos. I tried to respond to that dilemma by saying that the options Jerry canvassed were non-exhaustive. I appeal to the fact that Rawls defines the basic structure as a set of institutions, and that he uses that as a kind of technical term, I think. Treats profoundly influential institutions as ones that are the embodiment of rules that are public in three respects. Those respects depend on the degree to which the rules aren't self-effacing, and they provide clear standards of permissibility, aggregate conformity of which is verifiable. I emphasize aggregate here because Jerry, in his book, suggests that publicity requires you to be able to verify whether each individual is conforming with a norm, I think. To tell you, that possibility never crossed my mind when I was considering publicity, and I think it's more charitable to Rawls to assume that he's talking about aggregate levels of conformity. I then argue that on the assumption Jerry's egalitarian ethos is going to contain both distributive requirements, requirements akin to the ones that Shawna was discussing very interestingly in the previous section, and productive requirements, requirements to offer your labor at a just price, and the ethos contained, as Jerry allows, an agent-centered prerogative and permits compensation for special labor burdens and distinguishes between inequalities that are strictly necessary to motivate productive activity from those which are merely necessary in an intention-relative sense, that the egalitarian ethos is really going to be insufficiently clear and verifiable for it to qualify as realizing a set of public rules. So then I claim that the institutional definition enabled the basic structure to escape both horns of Cohen's dilemma. So the thought was that principles which are capable of institutionalization, such as the lax difference principle, which just applies to public policy, are better able to perform the social role of facilitating well-ordered social cooperation than principles incapable of such institutionalization, like Jerry's strict difference principle, which contains the egalitarian ethos. For that reason, there is at least some reason to restrict the difference principle to the basic structure. And let me elaborate there. Rawls has the idea of a well-ordered society in which everyone accepts the same principles of justice and their justification, and it's common knowledge of this, and that individuals and institutions conform with those principles. He thinks that's something which I think is both intrinsically and instrumentally valuable. It's a great social good for people to be able to regard one another as doing what they ought to do, as expressing due concern for one another in the design of their institutions and conformity with them. And it's also instrumentally very important, because given what human beings are like, the manifestation of this type of concern is likely, Rawls thinks, to be self-perpetuating. Individuals are more likely to acquire a sense of justice in that type of society, where it's public knowledge that people are acting justly. So, for that reason, I thought that it wasn't arbitrary for the basic structure of principles of justice, Rawls's principles, to be restricted to the basic structure construed in that way. There was some reason for it. And it wasn't inconsistent for Rawls to treat patterns of individual influential activity differently, depending on whether they were the embodiment of public rules or not. Now, it was also important for me to suggest that rules, this particular view wasn't as restrictive as Jerry suggested the restriction to legal institutions was. I wanted to suggest that there could be a publicly verifiable gender egalitarian institute ethos which prohibited the types of sexist distributions of benefits and burdens Jerry opposed. So the thought was the informational demands of that ethos were much less than the informational demands of Jerry's market ethos. So my main ambition here was to try and show that Rawls's view wasn't incoherent. It was just a kind of rebuttal, if you like, of Jerry's reply to the basic structure objection. And I noted various qualifications at the end of the paper. I said that some people might reject the appeal to publicity as the relevant property of institutions, because they thought it was irrelevant to disputes about justice. I remember Adam was the person who, I think, first pressed that on me. Second, they just might say, even if this distinction between justice and other distributive principles isn't significant, it's just implausible to attach so much importance to publicity. I also imagine somebody saying that it was possible to devise a market ethos which, unlike Jerry's ethos, was public. I think I anticipated that there could be some ethical norms which limited inequality. I rather hoped there would be, actually. But I thought Jerry was being overambitious in thinking, well, it would be overambitious to think that that type of norm would condemn as many inequalities as Jerry's egalitarian ethos did. So, for example, norms which require you not to leave the country merely in order to get a higher salary elsewhere, I thought that might be the kind of norm which was publicly verifiable. And you could imagine a society which contained those types of norms. In fact, of evidence for it, Cuba was, and perhaps is, still that type of society. A large number of people have that type of attitude. So I didn't want to rule out those types of institutions. And that's why I think of my view as one which really doesn't just side with Rawls, but thinks there should be some concessions from Rawlsians to Jerry's critique. I take it that the Rawlsian view, as I understand it, is that once we have the two principles, the lax difference principle, fair equality of opportunity and the basic liberty principle in place, then there aren't requirements of justice of a non-enforceable kind which prohibit self-seeking market activity. My thought was just, well, maybe there could be some requirements, but they just aren't going to be as inequality-friendly, inequality-hostile as Jerry's. So I wasn't setting out to defend the what I think of as the orthodox Rawlsian view that he expresses when he talks about the distinction between the market and the forum, and treats the market as a device which achieves the artificial identification of interest. That's a phrase from Bentham. Now, let me say that, as I understand Jerry's book, he really kind of ruthlessly presses all of these objections. That's what I want to try to respond to. He also raises some other objections, which maybe I'll say a little about. One he draws on Shauna's remarks, which suggest that it might be harder to verify government conformity with the lax difference principle than workers' conformity with Jerry's egalitarian policy. That was true. That would be, I think, a very serious problem for the position I was suggesting. But I don't think it's true, actually. I won't go into that now, but if anybody wants to pursue that in the question time, I'd be happy to do so. So I'm going to talk basically about the view that appeals to publicity are irrelevant to disputes about justice, and a restated version of the implausibility charge that says, regardless of the answer to the first question, I give too much weight to publicity. So, now, I think of this argument about justice, I label it the alien factors reply. Jerry expresses it when he says the influence of alien factors on the output of the constructivist procedure means that what it produces is not fundamental justice. And the distinction between ultimate fact-free principles and adopted rules of regulation refutes Rawlsian constructivism as a meta-theory of justice. So as I understand the position, one way you could express it is via the argument that Rawls' theory of justice claims that inequality-generating incentives satisfy fundamental principles of justice. Justification of fundamental principles doesn't depend upon the truth of any contingent factual assumptions. And it doesn't appeal to any requirements unrelated to justice. According to the restated basic structure objection, the justification of distributive principles depends upon various contingent factual assumptions about limited information, for example, and the degree to which such principles satisfy publicity requirements. And there's an insistence that requirements of justice and publicity are unrelated, and conclusion then, or sub-conclusion, that the restated objection can be used only as a defense of rules of regulation, not fundamental principles of justice, thus can't vindicate Rawls's claim that inequality-generating incentives can satisfy fundamental principles of justice. And my response to this kind of position is similar to one which was suggested to me by Tim Scanlon's discussion of Jerry's critique of Rawls's treatment of the expensive tastes objection to welfare egalitarianism and generally the role of welfare as a standard of interpersonal comparison when formulating principles of justice. The general worry is really perhaps Jerry and Rawls aren't really addressing the same questions. Tim notes that Cohen and Rawls's treatment of expensive tastes, given in that treatment, he says there's some reason to think that they're not always talking about the same thing. This makes it more difficult than one might have expected to be clear about the exact nature of their disagreement. So basically, I extend this suggestion to the present dispute, and my worry is that premise one of the alien factor's reply isn't sound. Perhaps Jerry's correct to claim that Rawls's constructivism fails to identify pure and robust principles of justice, but he might still be mistaken to claim that Rawls aims to defend such principles, and that Rawls must do so in order to meet his own distinctive objectives. I also suspect, and I'll give a little reason for this in a moment, that Jerry might be mistaken to claim that Rawls's distributive principles are merely rules of regulation. Right. These are essentially interpretive points, so I'm going to have to make some dreary exegetical claims about Rawls's position, and in particular constructivism, since Jerry focuses on the constructivist dimension of Rawls's thought. As I understand Rawls's political constructivism, it's a doctrine in normative ethics. It claims that certain principles are capable of conferring reason-giving status on particular facts because those principles pass some relevant procedural test. For example, justice is fairness implies that because the difference principle would be selected by parties in the original position, the fact the US tax system permits inequalities detrimental to the least advantaged is a reason to reform that system. Now, as I understand Rawls's view, and Rawls's procedural test, the original position argument, it compares competing principles of social justice in part by their capacity to play a particular social role. It asks what a society would be like if institutions fully complied with the demands of certain principles and society then ran with population of human beings. Now, the social role is supposed to be specified by this collective ideal of well-ordered social cooperation according to rules which are public and stable in the sense they generate their own support. It's pretty clear this feature of Rawls's view is one that he himself thinks supports an aversion to more informationally demanding distributed principles. And for that reason, I think if constructivism is sound, then it favors the basic restated basic structure objection. It also clearly shows that whatever principles Rawls emerges from this test are going to be insufficiently pure and robust, that is, valid in all possible worlds, to qualify as fundamental principles of justice in Jerry's sense. So I'm going to readily grant that Jerry's right to claim that the constructivist appeal for the value of publicity can't establish that inequality-generating incentives satisfy fundamental principles of justice. And I'm going to cast doubt on whether those defending Rawls have to insist that Rawls ever claims or needs to claim that they do. I think basically that Alien Factory reply just doesn't address Rawls's position. I think this becomes clear if you just look at the opening few sections of Theory of Justice, which I don't think Jerry pays that much attention to. There, Rawls, I think, takes for granted that in natural language, terms like justice are pretty ambiguous. I think it was Sidgwick who said, no term is more difficult to define than justice. And for that reason, he gives a kind of partly stipulative account of what he's going to mean when he's describing himself as proposing a theory of justice. He defines principles of justice by reference to their stringency, their role, their plural grounds, and their fact dependence. We begin at the outset with this famous claim that justice is the first virtue of social institutions as truth is of systems of thought. I understand that to express a pair of conceptual claims. I'm assuming Rawls thinks that it's part of the concept of truth that it's the decisive standard by which we assess beliefs. And I think he's making a similar claim then about justice. He's saying, look, I'm looking for certain decisive standards. That's one of the marks of standards of justice. That just as in the same way, some people claim that it's in the nature of moral, it's in the nature of wrongness that it gives us very weighty, if not always overriding, reasons for action. So then there's a question about, well, what are the principles of justice, given they're going to have this property of stringency? The other thing Rawls does is define principles of justice in terms of their role or function. He says that they're principles which tell us how to assess competing individual claims and allocate benefits and burdens. He's also pretty clear that it's not part of the concept of justice, but it is relevant when engaging in substantive assessment of competing principles of justice to appeal to all sorts of what you might call non-distributive values, to appeal to values like non-comparative values, values like efficiency, values like stability, and I think publicity. And finally, he makes statements which make it clear that it's not part of the concept of justice that he's employing, that principles of justice are necessarily, as Jerry says, fact insensitive. It's perfectly okay for them to be true in some worlds, but not others. So, given that the question Rawls is addressing, right, what are the... let me say that Rawls says he's addressing principles of... He's asking the question of what are the sound principles of social justice, and he thinks principles of social justice are standards for assessing institutions, presumably standards which sometimes might guide institutional designers, then it's kind of multiple reasons to think that the question he's addressing is really very, very different than the question that Rawls is addressing, that the question that Jerry's addressing. So my my thought then is that given this kind of terminological, enormous terminological variation, then it's not at all clear that the alien factor's projection does threaten the claim that inequality generated in Santos satisfies some principles of justice in Rawls' sense. I mean, the game isn't over there, but there's lots more to say. But that's the initial suggestion. At best, I think the reply suggests there may be other standards those inequalities fail to satisfy. Nothing I've said so far has ruled that up. There might be sound, fewer, and robust, what you might call axiological principles, that rank states of affairs and that imply that the types of unequal outcome produced by the lax difference principle are in one respect regrettable. Jerry does often speak, I think, as if he's expressing axiological convictions. He says that the fact there are certain inequalities shows that the world is less than perfectly just. He distinguished, I mean, one way this becomes manifest is if you look at kind of subtle differences in Jerry's attitude to intention-dependent and intention-independent inequalities which arise between the original Tanner lectures and his later work. You might think that inequalities which were strictly necessary to motivate individuals to engage in productive activity, inequality generating but beneficial to the least advantaged, involve any injustice in some sense. And that seemed to be what role Jerry was granting back in his original critique. You can see how, from a Rawlsian perspective, which is to do with whether an inequality is the product of individuals or institutions being unjustly designed or individuals acting unfairly, would sustain that judgment. Like if somebody can genuinely say, I couldn't work in a way which produced this detriment, inequality that wasn't detrimental to anyone without this incentive, then we might think, well, there's not been any failure here. There's no failure to conform with an action-guiding duty. But later, of course, Jerry recognizes there might still be something wrong with this outcome. It still might be an outcome where some people are better off than others who are, well, worse off than others through no fault of their own. And in that respect, the unjust. And I think that involves just moving from the Rawlsian sense of justice to another sense. Now, I don't object to doing that necessarily. Perhaps there are some axiological convictions. Some people, when they're confronted with various states of affairs and just ask, how do you rank these states of affairs? Which is better, which is worse? Do have convictions about that. I do myself. I lead to many very enjoyable classes which have puzzled me, but you might think that's right, but there's a question about whether those convictions are addressing the same question that Rawls is addressing. Now, I mean, one way to think about this is, even if you're confident that certain principles are the correct principles for assessing institutions, you might still ask yourself, are the outcomes they produce regrettable? Or do you regret the fact that a Rawlsian society contains this level of inequality, or would you hope that it would produce this lower level? You might think that somebody who said, I have no view about that, was missing out on something, and that you did have at least some reason to hope for the more equal outcome than the less equal outcome, assuming they're both Pareto efficients. I don't want to rule that out. So, in fact, I think if I wanted to defend Jerry's position, it's those kinds of convictions that I'd appeal to. What I'd say is move from the claim that Rawls is making mistaken claims about justice. Instead, I'd say that these axiological convictions are ones that have relevance when we're assessing whether his claims about how to evaluate institutions are sound or not. One way to think about that is to think about what Rawls says about criminal justice. He seems to treat the institutions of criminal justice, the jury system, for example, as devices of imperfect procedural justice. That is, they're institutions which are justified in part by their tendency to bring about certain types of outcome, where we regard one outcome as more valuable than the other, and as relevant not just to ranking states of affairs, but to how we design institutions. Lots of us think that. We might think, even if we know that the criminal justice system is perfectly organized, we might believe it's bound to, on occasion, fail to give sufficient protection to individuals. As a result, some innocents will be punished. But I say, well, there's a sense in which there was no injustice there, but there's also a sense in which there was injustice. It's bad for innocents to be punished. It looks like if you're calling system of criminal justice a device of imperfect procedural justice, that is, a device where the goal is to satisfy some independent standard, you might say that that's relevant when we're designing the system. But strikingly, when Rawls talks about distributive justice, he insists that there aren't any independent standards to assess outcomes. So that seems to be the official view. It says instead, distributive justice is a matter of pure procedural justice. We have to run the actual institutions and see what outcomes they bring about. And then say, in virtue of the fact these institutions satisfy the two principles, the outcomes are justified, whatever they are. Now, I think one way, I think, to press Jerry's point is to say, actually, that pure procedural evaluation of outcomes when we talk about distributive justice is mistaken. What we should do is say that it is relevant whether the outcomes produced by Rawls in institutions are satisfied some further axiological principle. If you say that, then you can say that actually Rawls's view is not just incomplete, but unacceptably incomplete. He has to take a stand on these questions about how to assess judgments about fundamental justice. So that would be. I haven't really got anything conclusive to say here. It seems to be a kind of standoff. That's where the disagreement between the two views is likely to occur in a way that I think is most challenging for the Rawlsian position. And you can see that actually Rawls himself, on one way of reading him, is sensitive to that. Sometimes he makes remarks about the level of inequality produced when we organize institutions that, in a way that satisfies the difference principle, and says the outcomes just might strike us intuitively as too unequal. I take it he's not saying that, oh, well, the outcomes might jeopardize prior principles, like fair equality of opportunity or the basic liberty principle. Instead, we just might think that's too unequal an outcome. And the fact the outcome is so unequal gives us a reason to revise the institutions. So it's, there might be less of a disagreement then between Jerry and Rawls if that is Rawls's considered position. It really does involve a big concession, I think, to Jerry's claim, because it suggests that there are fundamental principles of justice. So I don't know what to say there. I'm not convinced that Jerry's shown that we definitely should evaluate institutions in terms of the outcomes they produce, but neither do I think that Rawls has a compelling argument for saying that we should treat these as issues of pure procedural justice. Now, how am I doing for time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. Okay. But I'll very briefly say something about the even more challenging criticism, I think, a revival of the implausibility objection to the basic structure restriction. Right. So let's suppose a society would achieve a lower level of racial discrimination in hiring if, in addition to implementing certain forms of legislation, employers also internalized a non-discriminatory ethos. Somebody might say, surely some distributive principles require such an ethos, even if it doesn't constitute a system of public rules, and condemns this discrimination as unjust, even if it can be eliminated only by such an ethos. If so, it's implausible to restrict Rawls's principles, assuming they condemn racial discrimination, only to the selection of public rules, and to regard conduct as unjust only if capable of regulation by public rules. Now, it seems very plausible to me. I don't want to deny that. So really, as Jerry notes in his book, what I do is suggest that we can exploit the fact Rawls says publicity isn't a constraint. Well, publicity is verifiability. We're talking about whether we can verify conformity to the principle. Isn't a constraint on principles of justice. Now, you might think it is, because Rawls talks about or treats non-self-effacingness as a constraint on principles of justice, and you might think that some of the slogans I use, like justice must be seen to be done, suggest that I treat publicity as having decisive importance. But I certainly don't think I have to say that, or that in fact that's what Rawls in fact does say, as some of the quotes I have in the handout say, just a desideratum. And so then the question is whether we can exploit that in order to this type of counterexample. Like, Jerry thinks the desideratum proposal is, as he says, unintelligible. I'm going to say I can understand that. Principles of justice are principles for evaluating states of affairs. Because there the states are described with full information, and we don't have to appeal to contingent factual assumptions to say which state is better than the other. So if you understand principles of justice in that axiological sense, then I can understand how somebody can say it's just not relevant what issues about verifiability. As I've insisted, we have to understand Rawls as advancing very different types of principles for institutional assessment. And it does make sense to treat publicity as relevant there. What's more, Jerry's own remarks imply that's true, I think, on one understanding of it. That's because because of the connection between rules of regulation and institutions. I emphasized earlier that I think rules as principles can be described as principles which are not themselves rules of regulation, but which are principles for assessing rules of regulation. If we assume that really an institution is a set of rules of regulation, like public rules of regulation. Right, so I think Jerry's idea about rules of regulation should be used to characterize rules as doing that way, if it's going to play some role. And Jerry does agree that publicity is relevant when we're assessing rules of regulation.
Sometimes
relevant, sure. Right, so it's perfectly intelligible then that the principles we employ to assess rules of regulation are going to be sensitive to the publicity, verifiability of conformity with those rules. So the question then is, why are these particular examples so convincing? Can I explain that in a way which doesn't generalize back to Jerry's ethos? I think you can, because I think our reasons to reject permissions for people to treat us in racist ways are very weighty. Perhaps they don't derive from our welfare, but they're certainly very weighty. And the reasons we have to insist on being able to act in racist ways are non-existent, or much, much less weighty. So it makes sense to say in this type of case, even if we think publicity is important, it might be defeated by these other considerations. I think the same thing about the war example. If we're at war, then we have very weighty reasons to defeat the Nazis. I might tolerate principles there, which impose burdens on me such that it's very difficult to know that other people are conforming with those burdens, because the stakes are so high. Now, let me say, I don't think this generalizes to the case of Jerry's egalitarian ethos. And that's because I assume that ethos requires me to sacrifice things which are really dear to me, my vocation, and all sorts of other things which are to do with your job, your relationships with other people, with your family, the amount of time you spend with your children. It asks me to do that in order to improve the wealth and welfare of other people. So I kind of think in these types of cases, it's reasonable for me to expect to know that other people are not merely trying to make these sacrifices, like that they're making a good faith effort. Think of Tony Blair saying to us, "You have to realize I was sincere. I was making a good faith effort." I have the same kind of attitude here. I want to know that people are actually accomplishing what I'm also trying to do, because I'm being asked to make such significant sacrifices, and merely in order to improve the wealth and welfare of other people. So I think that the cases are sufficiently different, the race case and the egalitarian ethos case, that it's not completely ad hoc to treat them very differently. But for that reason, I'm not yet convinced the basic structure objection has bitten the dust. Thank you. Let me say, can I say one other thing?
We were trying to applaud.
Well, you will now. The reason you will is I am such a bad person. I'm like a commentator's nightmare. I haven't given a paper to Wayne. In fact, I gave him a very poor handout only yesterday. Partly that's just because I find Jerry's critique so kind of
It's Jerry's fault.
Threatening. and partly because I'm chronically weak well. So what I wanted to say, I said this to Wayne, if I can atone in any way, then he should tell me. He said he doesn't believe in these kind of religious ideas, but if anyone else has any suggestions, I'm happy to hear them.
Well, send the suggestions to me.
Thanks.
Well, I can't let the occasion go by without saying something, first of all, about Jerry, in part because my relationship with Jerry is, in some respects, a little bit different from the relationships that others have testified to earlier in this conference. Not in one respect. I first met Jerry 35 years ago, and we have been friends ever since, and that has been a friendship which I have greatly valued during all of that time and continue to value. In part, but only in part, because surely Jerry is, of all English-speaking philosophers, the one with the greatest repertory of pop songs. but that doesn't make me distinctive in any way. This room is full of Jerry's friends. What's a little bit different about me is that we have a considerably more distant professional relationship than he has with some of the other participants here. Jerry and I are almost exactly the same age, so that precludes my ever having been his student, or for that matter, his ever having been my student. Beyond that, we've never really been colleagues, and we've never been collaborators on any joint projects, and there's considerably less overlap of philosophical interest between us than, again, is typical of the other speakers. This is due in part to the fact that, unlike Jerry, I grew up in a very bourgeois part of Toronto, in which, you'll have to take my word for it, Marxism was not on the agenda in my neighborhood. So I never developed any particular interest in Marx. And as for distributive justice, I always found it too difficult to work on, and so gravitated instead to working on simpler topics like utilitarianism. So I haven't really ever done much that directly interrogates or engages the kinds of issues that Jerry has really built his career around. Nonetheless, he has been influential for me to a much greater extent and in a particular way, which I'm sure he doesn't actually know or fully appreciate. Like many other people, over the course of a career, you identify a small group of philosophers whom you particularly admire for their powers of mind, for their depth, for the lucidity of their work, for their rigor, for their intellectual integrity, and sometimes on top of all of that, for the elegance of their work as well, plus the fact that they've applied all of those powers and all of those virtues to big and important questions. One of my philosophical heroes, one of the people to whom I dedicated my last book, which is on freedom of expression, was Herbert Hart, in whom I saw all of those virtues and much admired the man for exhibiting those virtues so in such an exemplary way. But Jerry belongs to that small circle of people I have always particularly admired as well. And when I came to read Rescuing Justice and Equality, I wasn't surprised, but I was delighted to find that it exhibited, again, to such a high degree, exactly those philosophical and intellectual virtues which I most admired him for. So, Jerry, thanks for being an inspiration to me over all these years. Turning to Andrew, I'm not going to say anything directly about the basic structure objection itself. What I do want to engage is the publicity issue, which is the sort of centerpiece of Andrew's disagreement here with Jerry. So just to, again, set this in context for you, this will be familiar to many of you. Jerry has this, what Andrew calls the alien factors critique of Rawls. And the alien factors critique consists of two claims, each of them a claim about what fundamental principles of justice must be independent of. So first, they must be independent of facts. Therefore, they must display what Andrew has labeled robustness. They must be robust. And secondly, they must be independent of other values. And Andrew labels that property purity. So they must be robust and they must be pure. And Jerry's case against Rawls, his basic or fundamental case as I see it against Rawls, is that Rawls's principles are neither robust nor pure. They're not robust because they're dependent on the general facts about human nature and society which are allowed to the parties in the original position. And they're not pure because Rawls imposes on the choice of principles in the original position these constraints connected to the concept of the right, namely Pareto, publicity, and stability. And so by virtue of the fact that Rawls's principles are neither robust nor pure in these senses, Jerry concludes that Rawls does not have any fundamental principles of justice. What Rawls produces as principles are not and cannot be fundamental principles of justice. Now, Andrew, as I read him, has been sort of nudged or driven over time to accept quite a lot of this conclusion. Not quite all of it, but quite a lot of it. So Andrew concedes on Rawls's, again, I guess I shouldn't say on Rawls's behalf, I don't suppose Rawls would have welcomed the concessions, concedes on the issue anyway, that Rawls's principles are neither robust nor pure. And he concludes from that, concedes on the basis of that, that Rawls indeed doesn't have fundamental principles in Jerry's sense of the term. They're not fundamental in Jerry's sense. They don't satisfy Jerry's demands for fundamental principles of justice. But Andrew wants to say they're still principles of justice in some other sense, some other interesting sense. And so he wants to position this difference between Jerry and Rawls as essentially conceptual or semantic. They have different enterprises, they're doing different things, but each of them is a worthwhile thing to do. And so Rawls's principles, even if they don't qualify as fundamental principles of justice in Jerry's terms, can be nonetheless valid or valuable in their own right or in their own terms. So this, as I understand it, is Andrew's response to Jerry's alien factors critique. Now, I'm going to set aside the robustness issue and the issue of fact dependence. That was partially explored, though not with particular respect to principles of justice, in the morning session, Joseph's and Tim's morning session today. I want to focus on the purity side, and in particular, I want to focus on the role of publicity as one of those values that Jerry argues infect Rawls's principles and therefore thereby deny them the status of principles of justice. And here what I want to suggest is that the concessions that Andrew makes on this point anyway are much more damaging to Rawls than he seems to realize or wants to allow. So let me remind you, again by this way of context here, about Jerry's pluralism. In Jerry's scheme, justice, distributive justice, construed as or understood as some form of equality, is one social value among many. And some of the others, again, we've seen this in some of the previous sessions, some of the others include efficiency or Pareto on the one hand, freedom on the other, but there are others as well. And as being within the context of Jerry's pluralism, then there can be, indeed, one would expect there to be, competition and conflict among these various social values, and therefore it may be necessary to negotiate trade-offs or to find trade-offs among them. Now, publicity in Jerry's scheme is one of these competing values. Jerry doesn't deny, as I understand it, the value of publicity. He doesn't even deny that it can be a virtue in a society, that its rules are public, in the sense in which he and Andrew share the conception of what publicity requires, namely that the rules be commonly known, that it be commonly known what they require, and it can be commonly known the extent to which there is general conformity to them. So those are the constituents of publicity. That's common ground between Jerry and Andrew. At least Jerry doesn't dispute the conception of publicity which Andrew advanced, nor does he deny the value of rules satisfying those publicity desiderata. So publicity can itself be a desideratum, or maybe one might even elevate it to the level of a virtue, for social rules of regulation. However, and furthermore, by virtue of its being a desideratum for such rules, we may need to trade it off against the competing values, including justice itself. And so we may, for instance, prefer social rules of regulation, which approximate the principles of justice, but don't realize them fully, if it's easier for them to be understood, generally understood, and generally conformed to. We also might prefer somewhat less demanding rules if, again, they satisfy publicity condition such that knowledge of general conformity is more forthcoming for such rules. So we can compromise our social rules of regulation on the justice side in order to satisfy publicity. But, and this is, as I understand it, Jerry's basic point, all of this is irrelevant to determining what justice is. If our aim is to determine what the virtue of justice is for a society, then all of this emphasis on the competing value of publicity tells us nothing whatever about what justice is, nothing whatever about the nature of justice. So his basic Jerry's basic argument against publicity is that if it is correct, or if it is persuasive, that rules incorporating publicity constraints, sorry, if Jerry's basic argument is correct or is persuasive, then rules that incorporate publicity constraints cannot be principles of justice. The point isn't that they can't be fundamental principles of justice. I think the issue about whether they're fundamental or not is actually a side issue here. The point is they can't be principles of justice, whether they're fundamental or not. They're principles about the wrong thing. They're principles about something else, something other than justice. At best, they can be social rules which incorporate justice requirements plus some non-justice requirements. They can be hybrid or complex or all things considered social rules. They can play a role in such rules. But they cannot themselves tell us what justice is or be principles of justice. If that's the case, again, if Jerry's argument is correct or persuasive, then Rawls doesn't have any principles of justice at all. The original position, construction, as Rawls runs it, doesn't give us principles of justice, not principles of justice in any sense. Now, this seems to me to be not merely damaging, but fatal to the ambitions of a book called The Theory of Justice.
I agree.
And to a theory called Justice as Fairness. So I don't think that Andrew can really concede on this point as much as he's conceding, because it seems to me the concession is really fatal to Rawls. And I don't yet see how Andrew is able to mount an effective defense of Rawls against the critique so construed. So that's what I want to say about Andrew's treatment of publicity. I do want to make a related point. It's distantly related, too distantly related for this to be a response to something that Andrew actually included in that paper. So this should be seen really as being addressed to Jerry rather than Andrew. So my apologies to Andrew for what is about to come. I want to say something about what Jerry calls his strong thesis in Chapter 7, in part because it caught my eye, in part because nobody else has discussed it. So again, let me give you the background. The weak thesis is the one we're familiar with already. Applied to principles of justice, what it tells us is fact-sensitive principles of justice must presuppose some fact-insensitive principles. So that's the fact-insensitivity issue that we've already explored. I'm not going to say anything about that. I'm agnostic on that issue. The strong thesis claims that fact-sensitive principles of justice must presuppose fact-insensitive principles of justice. That is, it has to be justice all the way down. So on the strong thesis, principles of justice can't be grounded in any fundamental non-justice principles. So that's the thesis that interests me. Now, this gets much shorter treatment by Jerry than the weak thesis, which occupies a whole chapter. So this goes by in a couple of pages in Chapter 7. And Jerry says, to be fair to him, he has no formal demonstration of this, of the weak, of the strong thesis to offer. But he does provide an argument. And the argument is in the nature of a reply to an objection. So some unnamed objector has said something like the following. What about rights? What about principles of basic rights? Surely they're principles of justice. But can't they be supported by non-justice principles like appeals to the general welfare? If so, isn't this a counterexample to the claim that principles of justice must ultimately be grounded in principles of justice, must be justice all the way down? It's Jerry's response to that objection that I want to focus on here. So what Jerry says is that it's too simple or too easy to assume that principles of rights must always be principles of justice. They're principles of justice only if the rights satisfy a certain condition, which Jerry calls strong individuality. They must be strongly individual. And what Jerry means by saying that they must be strongly individual is that the violation of the rights gives the victim a special grievance against the violator, positions the victim in a special way against the violator. So it's not just a violation of all of us. It's a violation in a particular way of the victim who has a special grievance. And Jerry goes on to argue that rights that are justified by appeals to non-justice considerations like the general welfare will not be strongly individual in this way, and therefore any rights that are so justified will not count as the principles of those rights will not count as principles of justice. So that's essentially the argument. Now, first thing I want to note about that is that if that argument is correct, then a number of philosophers we thought had theories of justice don't. Mill, you may recall, identified the domain of justice with what he called perfect duties, which are essentially duties that correlate with rights. But if Jerry, and then of course went on to justify or ground those rights, those duties to those rights, by appeal to the general welfare. So if Jerry's right, then despite all that Mill seems to be trying to do in the last chapter of utilitarianism, he doesn't actually have a theory of justice after all. And I think the same would be true of Sidgwick, and possibly even true of Kant. If Kant's duties of right are grounded in the universal law formulation of the categorical imperative, and if, as it seems to me at least, that's not itself a justice principle. So some classic philosophers run the risk of losing their theories of justice if Jerry's argument is correct. But I don't think the argument is correct, or at least I have serious doubts about it. So I want to argue that whether rights are strongly individual is one thing, how they're justified is another. And the nature of the justification and whether it appeals to justice or non-justice considerations doesn't bear on the question of whether rights are strongly individual. Now, strongly individual rights have to confer a special normative status on the right holder. Now, rights can do this in a number of ways. One of them is to construe rights as claims, claims that are held against assignable others who have duties owed to the claim holder. And the fact that the duties are owed to the claim holder identifies the claim holder as occupying a special, distinctive, normative position. But you can add on to that, as others, as some, including Hart, have, that in addition to claims, rights confer upon the right holder a bundle of powers over those claims. So the right holder is in a unique position, not only by virtue of being the object of a duty owed to her, but also having normative control over that duty. For instance, the power to waive the duty, the power to seek or not seek enforcement of it, and so on. All of these situate the right holder as occupying a unique or distinctive normative position. And we can see paradigms of rights that have this structure, this sort of normative structure, in both property and contract. And both property rights and contract rights, contractual rights, seem to me at least to be paradigmatic matters of justice. At least we normally think that the violation of such rights are paradigm instances of injustice. And furthermore, those rights so construed seem to conform to the general conception of justice that Jerry subscribes to, namely of giving people their due. The rights seem to specify what it is, at least in this domain, to give people their due. Now, Hart felt that these were, as it were, paradigmatic rights, the ones that fully satisfied Hart's view about what a right should look like, because Hart subscribed to the will theory and not the interest theory of rights. That doesn't matter so much, but he did think that we find the best examples of rights of this kind in private as opposed to public law. Now, what I want to suggest is that we can fully understand what it is for rights of that kind to normatively privilege the right holder, to give the right holder a special or distinctive normative position, including a position in which the right holder has a special grievance against anyone who violates that right, without knowing anything about how those rights might be justified, or how an entire system of such rights might be justified. Now, maybe the most plausible stories of justification for rights of that kind are going to implicate matters of justice or perhaps fairness. But some have thought, at least, that one can give justifications for that kind of distribution of normative positions by appeal to non-justice considerations like the general welfare, which is what Mill said. So, I want to suggest, contra Jerry, the rights are matters of justice as long as they are contoured in this way, so as to confer on the right holder these kinds of normative privileges. And that holds independently of how one might then go on to justify the rights. And in particular, whether or not that justification is to justice, appeals to justice all the way down. But if that's the case, then the strong theory is too strong. Thank you.
Thank you.